Only the victim is alive and the murderers are not. It's a pity you didn't know when you started your game of murder that I was playing too.
It has been established that the persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
First simply disappears, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host, Ashlana, welcoming you back to the second half of the Charles Manson episode that was released on Monday. It's crucial to refer back to part one, so if you have not listened to part one, go back right now and listen to it, because the early life and the crimes were discussed, and it's very important to understand the 17 years that Charles Manson spent in reformatories and prison. I went into the rejection he faced from his teenage mother, and I cover his first two crimes that included a murder that started Charles Manson's paranoia, which led him to the infamous Tate and LaBianca murders. So if you haven't heard part one, go back right now, because part one is important for debunking the Helter Skelter theory, which I will further explore in this episode. I'm picking up exactly where we left off in part one, and I'm jumping right into it. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains mature subject matter involving graphic descriptions of drugs, racism, religion, crimes against children, sexual assault, rape, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Later that evening, Charles woke up Patty Krenwinkle, who had been sleeping off an acid-induced high. He instructed her to accompany Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, and Linda Kasabian to resolve a problem.
If I say stand on the mountain, and I say do it, it gets done. If it don't get done, then I'll move on it, and that's the last thing in the world you want me to do. Get up, Patty. I need you to go somewhere with Tex and the other girls. Go on now. Tex, get on over here.
What do you need?
It's time to get something done. The girls are ready to do whatever's necessary. They don't have a plan or a place picked out, so it's up to you, Tex. But I think it'd be best to hit some of them rich pigs' places.
All this needs to be done tonight.
Yes, I said it. Get some bolt cutters or something to cut a phone wire or gate. Take whatever else you need, put it all together, get going.
Jeez, oh, Charlie, you know, my mind's not working. I can't think of a house.
Come on, Tex. You've been to a lot of those rich guys' places. You know the neighborhoods. Find somewhere like where Terry used to live. Make the girls do something to get their hands dirty. Maybe take some rope and hang somebody. Make it look like a gang hate crime. Put the blame on someone else.
All right, Charlie. If that's what you want, I'll do. Girls, it's time to go. Let's get in the car.
This is the true story of Charles Manson and the family. On the morning of Friday, August 8th, 1969... Charles Manson was approached by Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, Mary Bruner, Linda Kasabian, and Lynette Squeaky Fromm, who were filled with excitement. They had come up with a plan to secure Bobby Beausoleil's release from jail. Susan Atkins told the group, quote, "It will work. At Gary's house, we wrote a bunch of things on the wall, like political piggy, and drew panther paw prints and that kind of stuff. We can do it again, and they will think the blacks did it. It will be Helter Skelter." Charles explained that her words had reflected the paranoia that he had been facing after the murder of Bernard Crowe. Charles was aware that if he was directly involved, it would risk his own return to prison if caught. He didn't want to personally engage in the plan. However, he didn't object to their idea of carrying out a copycat murder. Charles had told Tex Watson that if it were not for his drug burn with Bernard Crowe, that the family would not be in this mess. So it was Tex's responsibility to fix the problem when the time came. Charles amped up the guilt trip by telling Tex that he had killed Bernard Crowe to save Tex's life, and now it was his turn to save Bobby's. Tex Watson expressed having no issues committing the murders. Later that evening, Charles woke up Patty Krenwinkel, who had been sleeping off an acid-induced high. He instructed her to accompany Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, and Linda Kasabian to resolve a problem. Linda Kasabian was selected to drive to Beverly Hills that night, as she was the only member with a valid driver's license. It was close to midnight upon their arrival at the 150 Cielo Drive mansion. Linda parked the car on the street, and the three girls sat in anticipation and uncertainty awaiting Tex's orders. Patricia Krenwinkel recalled.
Susan, Linda, and I were left by our car when Tex left towards the property. We had heard four gunshots. That is when he had murdered 18-year-old Stephen Parent, who had been sitting in his car on the street.
Tex Watson had left the car and came upon Stephen Parent, an 18-year-old who had just left the Tate residence. He was in the process of opening the electric gate in the driveway when he had heard a gruff voice yell, "Halt!" Stephen begged Tex to please not hurt him and that he wouldn't say anything. Stephen raised his arm to protect his face as Tex swung the big buck knife at him, slicing through Stephen's watch off his wrist. Tex stabbed him and shot him in the face four times in rapid succession, killing him. Stephen had been visiting the Tate residence to meet up with his friend William Garrettson, who worked as a caretaker for the Polanski Tate residence. His purpose for being there was to sell William an AM/FM radio.
Tex came back and told us to follow him. Tex was able to break into a window and let the three of us girls in through the front door. Once we got to the living room, Tex was dealing with who I believe to be Jay Sebring.
Jay Sebring was a 35-year-old Korean War vet who had learned to cut hair in the war, and he became a successful hairstylist to the stars. That evening on August 8th, Jay had gone to dinner at El Coyote with his friends 32-year-old Volchek Frykowski, a good friend of Sharon Tate and her husband Roman Polanski. Volchek had brought his 25-year-old girlfriend, coffee heiress Abigail Folger, the daughter of Peter Folger, the renowned figure behind Folger's Coffee. And the final dinner guest that night would be the beautiful 26-year-old Sharon Tate, who had been 8.5 months pregnant at the time. Sharon was married to famous French-Polish director Roman Polanski, who was in London at the time of the murders. The friends had just enjoyed a lovely evening out and were now back at Cielo Drive. As the night grew late, Volchek found himself dozing off on the couch, while Abigail immersed herself in a book in her room. They had been staying at the Tate and Polanski residence with Sharon. In the main bedroom, Sharon had been lounging on her bed talking to Jay Sebring when Tex Watson entered the room and pointed a gun and knife. Jay stood up shielding Sharon and asked who the strange man was, and Tex responded,
"I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business."
When Jay asked what he wanted, Tex said, quote, "You have to die in order to save my brother." Susan Atkins and Patricia Krenwinkel rounded up Volchek Frykowski and Abigail Folger, bringing them into the living room. Tex led Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring downstairs into the living room as well, directing them to lay down on the floor in front of the fireplace. Jay began defending Sharon, explaining that her condition, as 8.5 months pregnant, made it impossible for her to comply. Moderately frustrated, Tex proceeded to tie a rope twice around Sharon's neck as she pleaded, looping it over the ceiling beam. Tex then fastened the other end of the rope around Jay Sebring's neck. Jay was overcome with anger at the rough treatment of Sharon Tate. He confronted Tex, and in response, Tex callously shot Jay in the stomach and proceeded to deliver several forceful kicks to Jay's face, breaking his nose and eye socket before ultimately stabbing Jay 7 times, leaving him to bleed to death in front of everyone. Patricia Krenwinkel was told by Tex to tie up Volchek Frykowski with a towel. Susan Atkins then towered over Volchek with a knife, and Tex coldly warned his victims that they were going to die. Panic then gripped the room as Volchek Frykowski launched at Susan, knocking her to the ground, and he proceeded to run out into the front lawn. Tex raced after him and hit him with a blow to the head with the butt of his gun. He continued to bash his poor victim 13 times, bending the barrel of the gun and breaking the grip. The scream of Volchek Frykowski dying was heard by a nearby group of Girl Scouts. Seeing her chance, Abigail Folger took off running away from Susan Atkins and Patricia Krenwinkel. But Patricia Krenwinkel began her pursuit.
Abigail began running down the hallways. I took off after her with my knife raised above my head. She ran through the back door onto the front lawn, and I began stabbing her a total of 28 times. At one point, Abigail said to me, "I'm already dead."
Linda Kasabian had been the driver that night, and she was standing in the driveway and yelled at Susan to stop the massacre. But Susan Atkins calmly said, "It's too late." Susan then went back inside for the pregnant 26-year-old Sharon Tate. Linda could hear the dying screams of Abigail Folger as Patricia Krenwinkel, who was soon joined by Tex Watson, stabbed Abigail a total of 28 times. Sharon Tate began pleading for her captors to take her hostage and wait to kill her until she had her baby, but Susan Atkins recalled feeling nothing as she stared back at the terrified actress and said, quote, "Look, bitch, I don't care about you, and I don't care about your baby. You're going to die, and I don't feel a thing about it." Tex Watson trudged in and told Susan to kill her, and Susan Atkins recalled, quote, "I killed her. I just stabbed her, and she fell, and I stabbed her again. I don't know how many times. I don't know why I stabbed her." Sharon Tate was stabbed in her abdomen a total of 16 times, killing both her and her unborn child, who was due in only weeks. Susan Atkins would later claim in her previous statement of being responsible for the fatal wound that took the life of Sharon Tate and her unborn child was nothing more than a fabrication. Her intention behind the falsehood was to instill fear among her fellow inmates in the jail cell. Tex Watson would testify in court that he was the one who ended Sharon's life. Tex revealed that earlier, Charles Manson had instructed each of the girls to actively participate in a gruesome act, ensuring that they all had blood on their hands. As a result, both Patricia and Susan took turns passing the knife around, repeatedly stabbing the lifeless bodies. This horrifying revelation explains the staggering count of 102 stab wounds inflicted on the victims. Tex Watson and the girls had the intent of hanging all the bodies in a cult-like ritual afterwards, but they were too exhausted. Neither Tex Watson or any of the girls had any knowledge of the identities of the victims at the time. It was only days later, when the news broke out about the murders of Sharon Tate, that they discovered just who they truly were. Tragically, Sharon Tate, along with her unborn baby, Paul Richard Polanski, Jay Sebring, Volchek Frakowski, Abigail Folger, and Stephen Parent did not survive the horrific night. Woof. So after everyone was murdered, the house was quiet, and Charles had told them to leave behind something witchy and to do it good. So Patricia Krenwinkel, she used a towel and she dipped the blood of Sharon Tate and wrote pig on the front door of the house. It's important to note that the family, the Manson family, had roughly 30 members at this point, and only a few of them knew about the Tate and LaBianca murders. It wasn't until the trial that they knew that something happened. And they didn't know why Patricia Krenwinkel, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, and Leslie Van Houten were glued to the radio after August 9th. So after these fruitcakes left the Tate house, they made it back to Spahn Ranch, and as soon as the car pulled in, Susan Atkins jumped from the car. She was full of excitement, and she wrapped her arms around Charles, and she said, "Oh, Charlie, we did it, we did it. I took a life for you." And Charles was like, "Nope, nope, nope. I am not saying that I had any part in this," because he's manipulating the situation. And he tells her, quote, "What you did for yourself. What you've done is lock me to you." Now they're all complicit, and if one gets caught, they're all going down. And that's what Charles Manson wanted. He felt no remorse for the fact that these kids just went and killed innocent people. And Charles Manson stated, quote, "A normal person would find the details of that night's events shocking and horrifying. But I had long ago stopped measuring myself by society's standards. The story I was hearing from Tex and Sadie, aka Susan Atkins, didn't shock me. I did not feel pity or compassion for the victims. My only concern was whether it resembled the Hyndman killings. Would the police now have reason to believe that Bobby was not the slayer of Hyndman? And were the kids clever enough to avoid leaving prints or evidence of their identities?" End quote. Tex and Susan, they were elated. They had no remorse upon their return. Where Linda and Patricia, they were more in a somber mood and they didn't feel good. So Charles actually told them just to go to bed. Charles started then talking to Tex and Susan to get the rundown of what happened. And Susan didn't shut the hell up. She was bouncing up and down, and she wasn't even high. She was like, "This is so cool, Charles, we just did the coolest thing." And they explained the murder, as I detailed, and Charles at first was suspicious because he knew that apparently Tex and Susan had a flair for dramatic exaggeration. So Charles decides to go back to the Tate crime scene with another member of the Manson family to clean up and make sure that no evidence was left behind. Charles said that the way Tex and Susan described the crime scene was accurate. They didn't embellish anything, but they left the murder scene too messy. So the murders were discovered later that morning by the Tate Polanski housekeeper, Winfred Chapman, and she called the police. Now, Officer Jerry DeRoss was the first to arrive at the Tate house, and he recalled the silence being eerie, and upon entering the home, the sound of the flies swarming the bodies was almost deafening. That's so scary. Instantly, the news of Sharon Tate's death and the other murders swept the media. And this is when Charles discovers who they had killed. And he was pissed off because they just killed a bunch of celebrities and they only brought back $100. So in a state of panic, the LAPD, they found themselves clueless about the identities of the suspects. They had no idea, and leaving them unable to connect the dots between the Gary Hindman case and the Tate murders. So this realization, it sends Charles Manson into madness. Charles then tells his group, okay, we have to commit another murder because the police aren't linking the Tate murders to the Gary Hindman case. So Bobby's going to stay in jail and he's probably going to rat on us. So we have to go out. I'm going to go with you because this has to be done right. And we're going to commit another murder. Charles explained that he felt compelled to commit a murder this time because he was going to accompany them and he wanted to make sure that it was executed correctly. He wanted this murder to be linked to the Tate murders and then to be linked to the Hindman murders so Bobby could get out of prison. During the early hours of August 10, 1969, Charles Manson, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Linda Kasabian, Leslie Van Houten, and another member named Stephen Dennis, also known as Clem Grogan, they all consumed a small dose of LSD, though not enough to induce extreme hallucinations, but enough to provide a sense of moderate invincibility. They all get into the car, and then approximately 2 hours later, they find themselves in Griffith Park at 3301 Waverly Drive, the home of Lino LaBianca, a 44-year-old grocery store executive, and his 38-year-old wife, Rosemary LaBianca. After scoping out the property alone, Charles Manson spotted Lino LaBianca peacefully sleeping on the couch through a window. Returning to the car, he told Tex to join him and armed himself with a gun, while Tex grabbed his trusty buck knife. They entered the house through an unlocked door in the back, with Charles assuring Lino that their intentions were solely focused on obtaining money and that no one would be harmed. Charles had learned from past experiences that things could get messy when his followers declared that everyone would die. So this time, they refrained from making such statements. Charles asked if anyone else was present in the house, and Lino informed him that his wife Rosemary was asleep in the bedroom. Charles was feeling uneasy about attacking a man without provocation, so he purposely turned and instructed Tex to fetch Rosemary, hoping that Lino would retaliate in the process. However, when Lino failed to react as expected, Charles felt a wash of weakness consume him. He then decided to send in the girls, knowing that they would be capable of carrying out the act instead of him. Charles returned to the car and informed Patricia Krenwinkel and Leslie Van Houten that they were to assist Tex inside the house. He told them that they were going to hitchhike back to the ranch afterwards. Charles, accompanied by Linda Kasabian, Susan Atkins, and Steve Grogan, then left in the car, leaving Patricia, Leslie, and Tex at the LaBiancas. When Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel entered, Tex had told them to go deal with Rosemary LaBianca, who had been in the living room with her husband Lino, who was bound with a thin leather lace. Rosemary had been then taken to the bedroom by the girls, and had a pillowcase thrown over her head and a table lamp cord tied around her neck. When she heard her husband being murdered by Tex Watson, she grabbed the lamp and began swinging it in front of her at Patricia and Leslie. Patricia started calling for help in the bedroom, and when Tex entered, he found Rosemary still with a pillowcase over her head, aimlessly swinging the lamp still attached to the cord used to gag her. Tex then stabbed Rosemary and then told Patricia and Leslie to get their hands dirty too. Leslie would later brag that the more she stabbed, the funner it got, and she continued. Rosemary, in the end, had a total of 41 stab wounds. Leslie Van Houten then stabbed Rosemary, post-mortem, 13 times. Lino LaBianca had suffered 26 stab wounds, and after, Patricia Krenwinkel carved the word war across his stomach and left a two-pronged fork sticking out, as well as a knife through his throat. Charles would be pleased to find out that Patricia had wrote death to pigs and the word rise on the walls in blood. To his surprise, she attempted to write helter skelter on the refrigerator, but she spelt it incorrectly. Charles had told them to leave something witchy that replicated the Hindman and Tate murders. Afterwards, while still in the LaBianca's home, Tex Watson took a shower and the girls ate in the kitchen. They then hitchhiked back to the ranch. While the LaBianca murders were occurring, Charles had been driving with Linda Kasabian, Susan Atkins, and Steve Grogan. Charles had come down from his acid high and was no longer feeling brave enough to get his own hands dirty. Linda explained that after the LaBianca murders, Charles was planning another murder. Linda Kasabian recounted, quote, He asked me about a person that I had met on the beach just days before. He was an actor, and Charles said, "Well, we're going to go there, and I want you to kill him." At 1 a.m. on Venice Beach, Charles had dropped off Linda Kasabian, Susan Atkins, and Steve Grogan at the apartment of the new hit. Charles instructed her to knock on the door, and when the man answered, to slit his throat. Linda quickly made the decision to purposely knock on the wrong door, and then she explained that she had the wrong address. The trio then left, without killing anyone. By Sunday, August 10th, 1969, the newspapers and media began warning the world about the ritualistic murders of the actress Sharon Tate and company. The media believed it was a personal attack on celebrities, and this caused celebrities like Frank Sinatra to leave Los Angeles. Steve McQueen drove around with a gun, and even Tony Bennett went into hiding. One store in Los Angeles had sold over 200 firearms in 48 hours, and changing your locks had a 2-week wait list. When news of the LaBianca murder surfaced, the police believed that it wasn't a copycat killer, and that the Tate murders were not related. The first rumor that began to circulate was that Sharon Tate's husband, Roman Polanski, who had been filming in London, had been involved in the murders. Roman was accused by the press of being an accomplice. For the 8 months following the murders, Roman Polanski could not work on films. He did not want to do interviews or speak to the media while he grieved. When Roman was feeling ready to go back to work, he realized that no matter what he did in the film industry, people would judge him and wonder how he could continue with his life after such tragic events. Roman would accept that he had to remember Sharon and his child and make them proud, not for the public, but what Sharon loved him for being himself and enduring. Two investigators from the LA Sheriff's Homicide had been handling the Gary Hindman murders and approached the Tate investigators, explaining that both of the cases had similar words written on the walls in the victim's blood, only to be turned away. The Tate investigators couldn't imagine the two cases even being connected. On August 13th, 1969, 4 days after the Tate murders, Charles had asked Linda Kasabian to go visit Bobby Bosley in prison. Linda used this as her opportunity to leave the family, but she was going to have to try and rescue her daughter. She was unable to because the members had taken the children to a nearby waterfall. Knowing that she was not going to be able to escape with her daughter, Linda had to casually act as if she was going to see Bobby. Linda was terrified and worried that Charles would be able to read her intent. Linda went into her car and fled to New Mexico and went into hiding. She felt years of regret for leaving her daughter with the family. When the ranch would be raided a week later, the children were taken into state care, and Linda managed to cross back into Los Angeles and reclaim her daughter. The two went back into hiding, fearing the family. On August 16, 1969, Spahn Ranch was raided by the police after stolen cars were discovered on the property. A ranch hand that worked for George Spahn was suspected by Charles that he set up the raid. It was known that the man named Donald had hated the Manson family and believed that they were manipulating George Spahn. 10 days following the raid, 35-year-old Donald Shorty Shea was mysteriously murdered. His body would not be discovered until 1977, nearly a decade later. On October 10, 1969, the family was arrested on charges of auto theft and arson. The charges were soon dropped and the family members were released. However, Susan Atkins remained in jail for questioning about her involvement in the murder of a music teacher, Gary Hindman. While in jail on November 6, 1969, Susan Atkins was implicated by her cellmates when she was caught bragging to them about her being the person who murdered Sharon Tate. Susan Atkins continued to brag that she had a targeted list of celebrities, like Frank Sinatra, Elizabeth Taylor, and Tom Jones. On November 12, 1969, the Straight Satan's Gang president, Al Springer, had told detectives back in August that Charles had bragged about knocking off 5 pigs. Then, on November 17th, another Straight Satan's member, Danny DiCarlo, implicated Charles Manson in the murder of Spahn Ranch worker Donald Shea, a.k.a. Shorty. And right after, Manson family member Bruce Davis would also testify that, quote, "It was early morning at the ranch when Charles Manson came down and told him, Tex Watson, and Steve Grogan to take care of Shorty, as he was a snitch for calling the police to raid the ranch. Together, the three men murdered Shorty, and a family member, Barbara Hoyt, recalled prolonged screams to be painful like a horror movie. Both Bruce Davis and Steve Grogan would be charged with first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Steve Grogan, who is currently 72 years old, was released on parole in 1985. Bruce Davis is currently 81 years old and is still serving life in prison at San Quentin State Prison. On December 1st, 1969, the LAPD issued an arrest warrant for Charles Manson, Patty Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, Tex Watson, and Linda Kasabian. The trial began on July 15, 1970, with Chief Prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi. The prosecution maintained that the events of Gary Hyndman's murder and the Tate-LaBianca murders were in no way connected, and that only the concept of a helter-skelter race war had caused Charles Manson to lead a religious cult to start a race war inspired by the Beatles. Okay, Fear Cult, this is what you've been waiting for. After everything I have researched, it has come down to this moment. And you may have different opinions afterwards, and you're entitled to that. That's totally cool. Here's my opinion, and here I go. I personally believe that the helter-skelter race war theory is far-fetched and extremely dramatic. However, it did get Charles Manson and his vagabond of fruitcakes incarcerated in federal prison. So, Prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi did his job, but at the cost of possibly the full truth, in my opinion. Now, I'm not defending Charles Manson or saying that he didn't deserve to be convicted. He did. They all did. In the end, they actively made the choice to murder innocent people. It's the possible real motive behind why Charles Manson manipulated his followers to be complicit in violent crimes that has me not believing the helter-skelter theory. Are you ready? I'm so ready. Here we go. The official helter-skelter theory, it was proposed by Los Angeles District Attorney Vincent Bugliosi, and it was supported by the co-defendants in the murder trial, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten. On the other hand, there were those who argued the violent religious cult aspect, saying that Vincent Bugliosi lied to sell a book. Two former members, whose names were Sandra Good and Catherine, aka Cappy Gillis, they had been with Charles Manson since 1968, and they went on record to say, yes, they were trying to step out of society. None of the alleged stabbing practices or fake crucifixions were performed. They did not worship Charles Manson as a god or a messiah. And at the time, he was just the man who gave them a home. Yes, they used drugs. Yes, orgies were happening, but no worshiping of Charles. So the term Manson family cult was coined by the media during the trial to support the concept that Charles was actively trying to recruit people to set up an organization with the future intent of starting a race war. Are you still with me? This is a lot. So members stated that they could leave whenever they wanted and that no one recruited them. It wasn't until Charles got paranoid after he thought he murdered Bernard Crow, who he believed to be a member of the Black Panthers, that suddenly Charles became fearful of this black gang. Following the helter-skelter Bugliosi theory, the blacks would eventually listen to the Beatles' White Album. They would want to rise and kill white people. Ultimately, blacks would win, and because the Beatles were communicating with Charles Manson through music, basically telling him that the race war was coming that was called Helter Skelter, Charles Manson should take his followers and hide in the Death Valley caves until all white America was slaughtered. Then Charles and his religious prophet that he apparently thought he was would rise with the Manson family and show the black man how to rule, since the black man would not have the ability to rule due to lack of experience. That is Helter Skelter. It sounds really ridiculous when you say it out loud. Now, so Helter Skelter proposes that Charles Manson gave Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Leslie Van Houten, and Patricia Krenwinkle instructions to directly go specifically start a race war in America and leave Helter Skelter clues that the black people would see and initiate the war. The white people would see the words helter-skelter and blame the black people. So remember Linda Kasabian? She was the driver that night. She was there for both murders. Linda initially told her lawyer, Gary Fleischman, her version of the story the night of the murders. And to Gary Fleischman, none of this made any sense. And it didn't make any sense to the prosecution. So Gary Fleischman said that this is when Prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi created the helter-skelter theory, because it supported a narrative. Gary Fleischman said, quote, "I heard Linda's story the first time, the night they brought her back. None of it made any sense to me. And that's the problem. It was nonsensical. And there was Vince came up with the helter-skelter theory. but I never heard about that theory during the period I was representing Linda Kasabian. She didn't know anything about Helter Skelter. Dun, dun, dun. The next theory is the copycat theory, to save Bobby Bugliosi from prison so he wouldn't snitch on Charles Manson, because Charles still believed that he had killed Bernard Crowe. If he saved Bobby from prison, then he wouldn't tell the police that Charles, Susan Atkins, Bruce Davis, and Mary Bruner were also involved in the Gary Hindman murder. After the authorities discovered the body of Gary Hindman, shockingly on the wall, they saw in his blood the words political piggy accompanied by a gruesome paw print. So Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, and Bobby Bugliosi have all stated at some point that the Manson family wanted the perpetrator aimed falsely to implicate the Black Panthers. So after Susan Atkins and the girls heard about Bobby Bugliosi's arrest, Charles and a few Manson girls, they concocted a sinister plan to carry out copycat murders. And their twisted intention was to mislead the police into believing that the Hindman murder had also been committed by someone else, specifically the Black Panthers, which would release Bobby from prison so he couldn't snitch. 2 days later, the Tate-LaBianca murders happen. George Stimson, author of Goodbye Helter Skelter, he makes a critical point in the timeline of the Gary Hindman and Tate LaBianca murders. He said, quote, "I think it's important to look at the timing of this. You're looking at these murders that happened on Cielo Drive and Waverly 2 days later. I think it's very important that they happened then rather than a month or 2 weeks earlier. So that indicates that they were a reaction to Bobby's arrest and the idea of getting him out of prison by committing copycat murders." End quote. Over the years, this copycat theory has been substantiated by accounts from numerous Manson family members, including Phil Kaufman, Catherine Gillis, Bobby Bugliosi, Barbara Hoyt, Charles Manson himself, and even at one point, Susan Atkins, who said, quote, "Instantly the atmosphere at Spahn's ranch tightened even more. We figured it would be only hours before the police came down on us. But additionally, we were all affected by Charlie's obsession with getting Bobby out of jail. Bobby had been driven by the need to prove himself tough as Charlie, and now Charlie was possessed with the need to prove his loyalty to his brother, to die for him if necessary. Out of all the confusion and the mass of words, the constant use of drugs, came a vague sort of scheme to try to convince the police that Bobby could not have done the Hindman killing. It was a plan for a copycat murders that would make the police believe they had the wrong man in jail." End quote. That was Susan Atkins. That was Susan Atkins before the trial. Oh, this is so juicy. And Susan Atkins is just vile. Everyone in the family at one point said that she is crazy, that she was nuts. And when I see her, I picture her being that girl that's at the end of a hallway in a haunted asylum. That's what she reminds me of, like head down, hair from the ring in front of her face, but her eyes are looking at you. And then she like squeals and runs at you. That's Susan Atkins for you. So this next part is important because during the trial, Susan stood by the helter-skelter motive firmly, telling the jury that Charles Manson had everyone believe that he was a god and planned to be the helter-skelter messiah. But why would Susan testify to that after she already claimed pre-trial that it was all just to get Bobby out of prison? Interviews reveal that the Manson family members who were not on trial for first-degree murder didn't even know at the time that the Manson circle committed the murders. So why did Susan change her story to Helter Skelter? Well, in 1969, the DA was willing to overlook the brutality and involvement of Susan Atkins' actions during the murders if Susan testified as a primary state witness. This is very Carla Homolka. This is exactly what this reminds me of. Co-prosecutor Stephen Kay, he explained the deal by saying, quote, "The deal with Susan Atkins, the prosecution was going to let her plead to second-degree murder," end quote. The lead prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, proposed this deal to Susan Atkins. And during the trial, Vincent Bugliosi had a man named Kurt Gentry sit in the courtroom with him. Co-prosecutor Stephen Fry, he thought that Kurt was only a reporter. Turns out, Kurt Gentry was hired by Vincent Bugliosi to write a book about the Manson case, which would become the number one best-selling crime novel, Helter Skelter, and gained prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi fame and money. And here's the theory that Vincent Bugliosi created and used to convince the jury and the world that Charles Manson was guilty of first-degree murder without actually killing anyone. So I read Helter Skelter, and it is explaining how Charles Manson wanted to be a rock star who was obsessed with the Beatles, and he created a cult with a sole purpose of starting a race war straight out of jail so he could rule over black people. When he didn't land a record deal, he wanted revenge on producer Terry Melcher. The Tate House was chosen as a representation of the establishment that Charles hated, and by choosing this house as the murder scene, it would start a race war through hidden messages. He needed money, so he brainwashed his followers to kill Gary Hindman, then thought the blacks were taking too long to start a race war, so he indirectly told his followers to kill again, with the entire purpose of framing black people by leaving indirect messages to the Beatles' White Album on the walls, and that the motive for the LaBianca murders was completely unknown. The police would then blame the blacks, and the blacks would rise up and kill all the white people, leaving Charles and his cult, the only whites alive who knew how to rule, making him the messiah of the world. The Bernard Crowe shooting, and the drugs, and the Black Panthers, none of that is even considered in Helter Skelter or by the prosecution. And that is the theory that got Charles Manson convicted of first-degree murder. So in the 2017 documentary, Manson, The Final Words, the interviewer asks co-prosecutor Stephen Kay, if Charles Manson was trying to frame black people, why are they not writing something more obvious, like kill white people instead of Helter Skelter or pick? Stephen Kay, he responded that the Manson family cult probably just didn't think about it. They didn't think about it. That they were not ordinary people, and they were always trying to operate under the radar, which I will say that is valid. But to start off that rationalization with, they probably just didn't think about it. He goes on to say that a chosen black man would figure it out and tell someone, and that's how Helter Skelter would start. And then the interviewer just says, that seems like a lot of dots to connect. And Stephen Fry, he actually does the cringe face, that like, and then he just looks down and doesn't say anything. It's pretty awkward. So Vincent Bugliosi had went to the family member, Phil Kaufman's house, and according to Phil, quote, was trying to get stuff out of me that wasn't there. Now, the important question, why did Vincent Bugliosi need Helter Skelter, that theory, to work? It's established first-degree murder and the conspiracy to commit murder under California law. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? So the California Penal Code 182PC states a criminal conspiracy takes place when one agrees with one or more other people to commit a crime, and to one of them commits an overt act in furtherance of that agreement. Meaning, without proving the Helter Skelter theory, there was no evidence whatsoever that proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Charles Manson wanted each of these murders to happen. The Bernard Crowe shooting and the Black Panthers, the drugs, that isn't explored in Vincent's book or by the theory Helter Skelter, because at the trial, that changes the motive. It's no longer considered California Penal Code criminal conspiracy. And with that, you can't charge Charles Manson with a thing. And Charles Manson admitted many times that he was involved in drugs, that he had shot Bernard Crowe, which began his involvement with the Straight Satans, which ended in the murder of Gary Hindman. Bobby would then get arrested, and that the primary motive was the copycat murders to get Bobby Bugliosi out of prison. Charles went to his deathbed saying that he never killed anyone, which is technically true because Bernard Crowe didn't die, but the motive would not get him sent to prison. It doesn't implicate him in the Tate-LaBianca murders, which is what this case was focusing on. Family member Linda Kasabian's lawyer, Gary Fleischman, he thought that the DA had built a horrible case against Charles Manson, as he wasn't at the scene of the crime during the murders. Charles was 40 miles away. It was Tex, Susan, Patricia, Leslie, and Linda that were there at the scene. because the DA needed to prove that Charles Manson was involved in the Tate LaBianca murders, and the only thing that could tie him to this crime was if they used California Penal Code for conspiracy. The media spread the helter-skelter as 100% facts, where people are starting to show, like, no, it's bogus. But it did get Charles Manson convicted, which is good. But the truth is important. So the helter-skelter theory, it successfully got the jury to believe that Charles was guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy under the California law requirements, where Charles ordered the Tate LaBianca murders without saying, go kill them, under the term vicarious responsibility. Co-prosecutor Stephen Fry said, quote, "We didn't have any evidence that specific night that Manson said, go out and start Helter Skelter. He just said, go with Tex and do what Tex tells you to do," end quote. So returning to the Helter Skelter theory, it's argued that Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor, he disregarded crucial facts surrounding the Bernard Crowe shooting and the involvement of the Black Panthers, as well as the possibility of drug trafficking gone awry. These details were seemingly overlooked during the court proceedings. So if the prosecution were to acknowledge these facts, it would undermine the credibility of the Helter Skelter theory and raise reasonable doubt. They don't want that. That's not good. That's no bueno. So the documentary, Manson, The Final Words, poses an important question. Do the ends justify the means? Linda Kasabian's lawyer suggested that if the Helter Skelter theory had not been presented, then Charles Manson may have been acquitted or could have successfully appealed his conviction later on. This is due to the lack of sufficient testimony linking Charles Manson to any crimes related to the Tate and LaBianca murders. But Ashley, what about Susan Atkins? She initially said the copycat theory, but then she changed it to Helter Skelter for a plea deal. But why, in the end, if she had a plea deal, was she charged with first-degree murder and not second-degree like the police stated? Thank you, I am so glad you asked, Fear Cult. To convict Charles Manson, the witness had to corroborate the Helter Skelter theory. State's witness, Susan Atkins. So before the trial, Susan was in jail and Linda Kasabian was told to pass her notes that would undermine Susan Atkins' testimony while they were both in custody, with the purpose of strengthening Linda's bargaining position with the prosecutors to become state's witness instead of Susan Atkins. Linda's lawyer, Gary Fleischman, stated, quote, "I had Linda pass kites to her in jail. A kite is a little letter saying in Charlie talk that the DA is your lawyer. Charlie is the DA. Nonsense like that. And Miss Atkins was a little nuts, and she refused to testify. So now they were only left with Linda Kasabian," end quote. So now everything is juicy because the state prosecution no longer has a star witness that can corroborate their Helter Skelter theory. So they reach out to Linda Kasabian. The DA offered Linda murder in the second degree. Her lawyer, Gary Fleischman, rejected it. The DA then offered her voluntary manslaughter and again rejected it. He knew that his client was technically guilty of first-degree murder as an accessory, so Linda's lawyer was able to make a plea deal where Linda got granted full immunity. So after the trial, she would walk free. And Linda testified that the Helter Skelter theory was true. Linda Kasabian's lawyer, Gary Fleischman, explained, quote, "Linda and I typed up the immunity agreement, and that immunity agreement said, Linda Kasabian will receive full immunity if she testifies to the truth in the so-called Manson murders. The truth is as follows. I knew exactly what was necessary to convict Charles Manson, and whether that was truth or not was not my business. To decide that was Vincent Bugliosi's. I said, Linda, if you testify to that, you're going to walk out of that courtroom. And she did. The other co-defendants also testified the Helter Skelter theory as well. And my personal opinion is that they believed that if they did, they were hoping that they could minimize their roles in the murders and use it to increase their chances of parole or appeal. Linda Kasabian, after the trial, she went into hiding and she never spoke to the public until 49 years later. And she expressed so much guilt for being able to walk. Charles Manson would kind of defend Linda for ratting on him because he said that she was only with the Manson family for 30 days before the crimes and that she didn't know anything and she didn't know anything about him, that they'd only ever spoken about 50 words to each other. So anything the prosecution told her to agree with, meaning helter skelter, it must be true, so go with it. When Charles was given the death penalty, he wasn't surprised. He was just resentful. Not resentful for being convicted, but the way the story, the helter-skelter story, got manipulated by the media. Charles Manson stated in his book, quote, "It's obvious the right people are locked up, but the motives used to convict us, especially me, were absurd." Now, Bobby Bugliosi, remember him? Well, before the Manson trial, in November of 1969, he went to trial. And during his first trial, it was a mistrial, as the jury was hung 8-4. They couldn't come up with a unanimous verdict of guilty for the murder of Gary Hyneman. And not at any point during that trial was Helter Skelter brought up. The second trial took place after Charles Manson was arrested this time, and Bobby, Susan, and Charles Manson were convicted of the first-degree murder of Gary Hyneman using the Helter Skelter theory. So Bobby Bugliosi is currently 75 years old, and he's still in prison, where he defends the copycat murder theory was to keep him from prison, not Helter Skelter. But overall, the Manson trial was just insane. The media went nuts. The Manson girls would put X's in their heads that signified that they weren't actually a person. Charles Manson did it. He eventually switched his to a swastika. Very gross. And then something that was interesting was there was the defense attorney named Ronald Hughes, and his body was found dead in the forest. And an ex-Manson family member claimed that Hughes was murdered for disagreeing with Charles over Leslie Van Houten's defense. Suspicious. It just keeps building. Now, after 9 days of deliberation, on January 25th, 1971, 33-year-old Charles Manson, 21-year-old Patty Krenwinkel, 20-year-old Susan Atkins were sentenced to death. 20-year-old Leslie Van Houten was sentenced to death in connection with the LaBianca murders, and she was 21 years old. So during the Manson trial, the story was that everyone was brainwashed by Charles. However, when Tex Watson was tried separately in 1971, because he actually fled back to Texas, where he was deemed a nutter, and he, during the trial, was said to have acted on his own account and that he wasn't brainwashed by anyone. And he was found guilty and sentenced to death. Afterwards, all the death sentences were commuted to life in prison after California abolished the death penalty in 1972. On September 5th, 1975, these people, they're dropping like flies. Lynette Squeaky Fromm, she attempted to assassinate President Gerald Ford in Sacramento, California with a pistol. She was sentenced to 34 years in prison, and she was released on August 14th, 2009. And to this day, Lynette Squeaky Fromm is still in love with Charles Manson. In August of 1976, Leslie Van Houten's conviction was overturned and she was retried twice. And at the third trial, she was convicted of 2 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy to convict murder. But, there's always a but, on May 30th, 2023, the California Court of Appeal in Los Angeles set aside Governor Newsom's denial of Leslie Van Houten's parole, thus making her the first family member to have the court rule in her favor for parole recommendations. So, 74-year-old Leslie Van Houten was just released on parole this year, July 11th, 2023, after 53 years in prison. And this is crazy. Forbes reports that Leslie Van Houten's estimated net worth is $15 million. But it's important to note that this net worth doesn't necessarily indicate the amount of liquid cash that she possesses. The exact amount of her available funds is actually kind of unknown, but it's believed that the accumulation of money over the years of her in prison resulted from the various deals she made for interviews and book agreements. And to this day, 75-year-old Patricia Krenwinkel and 77-year-old Tex Watson remain in prison. And Patricia Krenwinkel is California's longest-serving female inmate. And in 2009, September 24th to be exact, Susan Atkins died of brain cancer. Then star witness Linda Kasabian, she died on January 21st, 2023 at 73 years old. And Charles Manson, he died too, and I'm sure the entire world recalls when that happened. A big cheer happened in unison on November 19th, 2017. Vincent Bugliosi, the author of Helter Skelter, passed away on June 6, 2015. Despite his death, his book has remained a primary source of information on Charles Manson, making it the go-to reference for many. During the 1970s, information was not easily accessible as it is today, and news reports and books were often considered the sole reliable source of information. This is why the Helter Skelter theory has become widely accepted as the definitive explanation for Charles Manson's actions. However, taking into consideration the emergence of former family members and witnesses coming forward in the recent years, the case has regained attention. It is fascinating to observe the efforts and evidence that was necessary to convict Charles Manson and keep him imprisoned until his death. These new perspectives shed light on the complexities of the case and challenge the long-standing narrative established by Bugliosi's book. While in prison, Patricia Krenwinkel and Susan Atkins received many fan letters in the mail. As they grew old in prison, their actions have never left them. Charles Manson, on the other hand, relished in his glory.
Every once in a while, I'll get letters from children, and they seem to think that what we did is all right. There is nothing, nothing that we did that is all right. Nothing.
Charles Manson is not a god or a prophet. He's a mean, bitter, evil little man, rightly behind the bars he is behind. He's a liar and a thief, and I've seen him terrorize, brutalize, beat, and threaten teenage boys and girls. Manson only wrecks lives. He was a part of my life that I wished for and never happened.
Every one of you out there has tried to kill me for the last 25 years, and I'm still here. Now what?
That is the true story of the monster who is Charles Manson and his followers. Just an absolute tragedy on the world. It's so sad. And pulling apart the case, it was really difficult because everyone involved was involved in the murders. Let me be specific. Everyone who was involved in the murders just made me roll my eyes. My heartfelt appreciation goes out to the exceptional quartet of Fear Cult voice actors who lent their incredible talents to this week's episode. Where do I begin? Okay, first off, we have Angel, aka Diary of an Outlaw, for his eerie acting as Charles Manson. It was very, very spot on. I was very impressed. So I follow Angel on Instagram, and he always posts uplifting and positive videos on there. And he did one where he said something along the lines of, love yourself and fuck what others think. And his voice, I'm like, man, that really reminds me of someone. Ding, 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 ding. Hey, Angel, buddy, you wanna do me a big favor there, bud? And I asked him if he wanted to volunteer his voice to play Charles Manson, and the rest is history. And he crushed it. He absolutely crushed it. Next, we have Raven, host of the Rogue Darkness podcast. She played Patricia Krenwinkel, and I always love working with her. She's been on other episodes, so check out her podcast, and she focuses on occult true crime. That's Rogue Darkness. It's fantastic. It's a great show. Thank you to Fear Cult member Amber, who worked her magic as Susan Atkins and blew my mind. You could really hear the emotion in her voice. It was very believable. I loved it. And I feel like I stacked my dramatizations this week, because next is the legendary Christopher, aka Captain Cook's Food, who played Tex Watson. So thank you to all of you who were on this episode. You did an incredible job bringing the stories to life, and I can't wait to work with you again.
There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now, and then they'll come for you.
Back on our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am doing something a little different. I'm going to be recommending one that is in theaters. I'm going to recommend Saw 10. It was so good. I'm recommending a movie that's in theaters. But if you're listening to this years down the road, just Google it. You'll find it. So Tobin Bell plays John Kramer, aka Jigsaw. He is back and he never disappoints. If you haven't seen the franchise, you can still watch Saw 10. Although I recommend that you do watch Saw if you have the opportunity to watch all of them, then finish with Saw 10. But if you haven't and you just want to jump to this one, Go right ahead. The plot involves John Kramer hoping for a miraculous cure, and he travels to Mexico for a risky and experimental medical procedure to cure his cancer, only to discover that the entire operation is a scam to defraud the most vulnerable. So armed with a newfound purpose, the infamous serial killer uses deranged and ingenious traps to turn the tables on the con artists. Because it was in theaters, I don't really want to say any more, because at this moment in time, it is in theaters. So go to lullabythefearpodcast.com to watch trailers for previous Neverending Quest recommendations. And we have come to the end of the episode. So thank you to everyone for listening. I hope you have a fantastic week. Follow Lullaby on Instagram and Threads at Lullaby the Fear Podcast. Rate, share, review the podcast. 5 stars really supports the show. So thank you for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.